This is XTP Media.
Centuries and Fortune were like a Nokia mobile phone that we never upgraded.
I think they should be put aside to be the new Red Arrows.
Are we actually going to have any aircraft to fly in 20 years' time?
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. And we're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 115 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by Ellie Carter, and Ellie's a pilot, STEM ambassador, and recently appointed chairperson of YES, the Light Aircraft Organisation's Young Persons Group. Congratulations, Ellie, and welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It's really great to now be chairperson of YES.
Well, I want to come back and ask you what that actually means in a minute, but first let me welcome our other presenter this evening. That is, of course, Tim Robinson, and Tim is the editor-in-chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Peter. Good to be back on recording again. Hello, everybody.
Unfortunately, Gareth can't join us. Today, we're going to catch up on what's been going on recently and also jump in to look at the impact of aviation in the recent UK's Defence Review document called Defence in a Competitive Age. We're going to look at some of the impacts of that on the UK Air Forces. Ellie, just want to come back to you. Since we last spoke, you've been appointed chairperson of YES for the Light Aircraft Association. Can you tell us what that is and what does that mean?
Yeah, so YES is essentially the youth branch of the LEA. We aim to kind of get young people into aviation and engineering because it's kind of an industry, especially in the UK, that is seriously lacking. So if we can encourage other people into it, that would be amazing. And especially from my kind of experience, there aren't enough young people, so it will be really awesome to get more people.
What is it that you think you can bring to that role? What's it entail being the chair of that group? What are you going to have to do?
So YES at the moment is quite a small charity, so I'm aiming on kind of expanding some social media and doing that kind of thing to kind of just put YES out there a bit more. And hopefully from there we can have a bit more of a presence at different events when COVID restrictions are eventually lifted. And by doing that, hopefully we can encourage as many young people as possible into aviation. A pretty big challenge, but hopefully it'll be doable.
Well, we know you've got a lot on your plate, and we've seen a lot of you recently, and that's because you've managed to get out and get flying. Tell us about how that's gone. What was it like? Did you first have to go out with an instructor again, or did you go solo straight away?
So at the moment, well, actually at the moment we can do instructors, but from the 29th we could fly solo. Luckily I have my PPL, so I can do that, and I'm insured on an aircraft. So I went up and did a few circuits and just some local flying to kind of get used to the aircraft again and the reintroduction to flying. But it was amazing to be back up in the air, and it was a really nice surprise to actually see that I hadn't lost that much and I can still fly an aircraft, which was awesome.
Nice crosswind landing, I noticed. Can you also tell us about the new aircraft type, I think? Have you got a new type rating as well?
Will that be the RV-12?
It might well be.
Because, yes, that was my last flight before the third lockdown, is it?
All right, okay.
There you go, but I guess nothing's actually happened since then, so essentially right. It's a new type.
I Well, let's move on. And talking of types, of course, we face the sad news last weekend of the passing of the Duke of Edinburgh. Tim, he was quite an aviator, wasn't he? Looking at the aviation and aerospace angle of his life, he was quite spectacular in terms of the number of aircraft he flew, and given his role, the amount of hours he managed to squeeze in.
Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, obviously, we've got Royal in the title of Royal Aeronautical Society, and Prince Philip was our honorary president in 1966, in the centenary year of the society. And I think he even got his presented as honorary fellow even earlier than that by none other than Sir Sidney Camm, who was then president in, I think, 1954. But what amazed me was he'd got almost 6,000 hours and 59 types, everything from helicopters to a single seat. He was the only royal that's apparently flown a single seat. Was it Dane Turbulent, which is a very rickety looking single seat kind of small aircraft. And there's even pictures of him at the controls of Tridents, and even being taken for a test flight with Boeing 757 when it was being sold to British Airways.
Wow.
So incredibly, you know, got his RAF wings, got his helicopter wings, got his PPL. You know, incredibly interested in flying, you know, and how he managed to rack up almost 6,000 hours, you know, obviously over a long time, but with a fairly demanding day job, I don't know.
Yeah, 40-ish different aircraft types, 6,000 hours. Ellie, given the job you're doing at the moment and the number of tasks you're trying to juggle, how do you think about that?
That's pretty impressive. It's very hard to keep your hours up and be very busy, and it actually almost takes a big commitment to plan ahead of I'm going to fly it and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that he was able to do that is absolutely fascinating and amazing. I'm kind of in awe.
Yeah, quite a spectacular man and a loss to aviation. Moving on then, last time we were all together, we were talking to Sarah Cruddas, and she gently reminded us not to forget about Ingenuity, which is the helicopter that Perseverance carried all the way to Mars. As of recording, we're recording this on the 13th of April, it's not yet left the ground, but we've seen signs of tests and a bit of movement. How exciting is this, Tim, that we're just about to see another aircraft, hopefully and successfully, lift off and land on another planet?
Yeah, well, hugely exciting. It's another Wright Brothers moment, isn't it? You know, atmospheric flight on another world. I mean, there's the spacecrafts that have lifted off from, so the moon. I think there's a couple of Surveyor ones and a Russian probe that they've, you know, and obviously Apollo 11 of it, you know, the LEM, you know, kind of took off from the moon. But in terms of atmospheric flight in a helicopter on another planet, that's pretty mind-boggling. So it's going to be a Wright Brothers moment. And interestingly, it shares something with high-altitude UAVs. So the propellers, I think, because of the thinness of Mars's atmosphere, I think they go about 2,400 RPM. It's obviously far faster than you would have on a a quadcopter or a helicopter on Earth, but it's about the same RPM as the propellers on Zephyr, which hail UAV, record-breaking UAV, which flies up at 70,000 feet, where again the atmosphere is very, very thin.
So, yeah, looking forward to that. So, hopefully, fingers crossed, by the time this comes out, maybe it might have flown, or maybe they've got a date for it to fly.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And that's the sort of thing, Ellie, that I suppose is going to attract younger people into the aerospace industry. It's exciting projects like this, really, isn't it?
Definitely. Anything to do with space is absolutely amazing. And I think there's so much involved with space travel, space flight, really something that everybody finds interesting. It's awesome.
Yeah. And what? Sorry, Tim.
I was going to ask, Ellie, in your generation, are more people of your age group interested in SpaceX and backing Elon Musk and SpaceX, or is it still NASA?
So I'm kind of a complete geek, so I spend my whole life around math students and physics students. I'm probably not the best person to ask. It's probably very biased, but 100% of them think both is awesome. There's constant discussions about NASA and Elon Musk and all that kind of stuff, but I think SpaceX is pushing forward so much at the moment that they're kind of the ones you hear about all the time.
I think you're right. NASA is hiding its light under a bushel a little bit. But as we said, ingenuity, perseverance, there's some really exciting stuff. While we're on space, let's just reflect as well. Yesterday was the 60th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's first manned spaceflight, and also the 40th anniversary of the first shuttle flight. Tim, two massive milestones. I daren't even think about talking to Ellie about these sorts of durations.
Here's where we should get Roland White in.
Yeah, into the black.
And Gagarin, you know, 60 years. And somebody said, I think somebody actually pointed out on Twitter today, is closer in time now to the Wright brothers' first flight than it is today. I think there's lots of interesting things, lots of inspiring things, but we've seen the shuttle obviously retired, and now sort of the US is back into a space into the crewed space game in a big way. So you've got SpaceX, Dragon, multiple missions. You got Blue Origin, Boeing as well. They've now got multiple capsules, and yet the Russians obviously persisted and kept kind of developing, but sticking with the tried and trusted Soyuz that still works today. What a rocket! In other words, that's still kind of lasted all this time. The basic design.
I was going to mention in our Promoting Aerospace segment a bit later the book by Stephen Walker called Beyond, the story of the first human to leave our planet. And, of course, it is Yuri Gagarin's journey into space. I've heard Stephen Walker talk several times on various podcasts, and apart from ordering the book immediately, it sounds fascinating. Some of the things that the Soviet Union did and the risks they took beggars belief, and really, really amazing things. For example, Stephen Walker makes the point in the book about the fact that, would the Americans and those test pilots ever have allowed them to put explosives on the rocket in case it fell into, or the capsule in case it fell into Western hands? They want to destroy it, so there's somebody sitting with a finger over the button. But there were all sorts of really fascinating things that came out of some of those conversations. So definitely recommend that book, and also put some links into a podcast called Cold War Conversations, which is a fascinating podcast in its own right, but a fabulous interview with Stephen Walker. So, really, really interesting. The risks they took to beat the Americans to space, to the first manned space flight, is amazing. Let's then just pick up a final handful of bits and pieces. Just on the airline news, we've just this week seen that the French government is looking to ban domestic and internal short flights in preference to people using trains. Also, and again, I don't know if it was linked to this, but we've also seen the London to Newquay flights not renewed this summer. Is there a trend here, do you think, Tim, on the green agenda to stop some of these short duration flights?
I think this is something that is going to take make airlines in Europe at least set up and take notice. Yeah, I mean this is a measure to that's just been voted in by French politicians. It was originally supposed to be under 4 hours. You know, basically the idea is if you can take a train journey, if the flight can be served by a train journey within under 2.5 hours, the flight will be, services will be banned and you should take the train. So it kind of works because France, obviously, it's a continental, big kind of continental land country, if one could call it that. And, you haven't got kind of highlands or islands, Western Scotland to worry about too much. So it's going to, it's going to affect sort of, obviously, kind of point to point, sort of travel there. Connecting flights ruled out. But I think it's going to be a big wake up call for airlines in Europe to say, guys, you've got to do something here, and this could easily sort of spread to other countries, and you've got to kind of think about this. It also helps as well as France's geography, is they have an excellent high-speed rail, don't they?
Yeah, I was going to make this point, Tim, because from where Ellie and I live, 2.5 hours would be great if we could get to London in 2.5 hours. But I think we'll be flying every day if that's the if that was the case.
And what's also interesting, I think, is I would have liked to have seen in that, if they were doing that, is a exemption for electric flight or hybrid electric.
Yeah. Well, maybe that will come in.
So if you could say, right, you've got to take the train, but if you were flying an electric aircraft, an electric airliner or a hybrid electric or something that would actually cause less pollution than a train, why would that be favoured?
Yeah, no, I agree. Very, very good point, that, Tim. Very good point. As I said, I don't think that's an option at all in this country until our train service and HS2, etc. are all in place and zooming around the country, because our geography is different. And certainly, as I said, certainly where I live, getting to places just like London is a 4 to 5 hour journey, to be honest. So better leave it at that and move swiftly on. After the break, we're going to look at the impact of the UK defence review.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Presented to Parliament by the Secretary of State for Defence in March 2021, defence in a competitive age has been best described as being shaped by budgetary constraints and, at worst, savage cuts. The RAF looks to have been impacted quite hard, but let's look at some of the changes. And without delving too much into the politics, let's try and better understand what's going on and what's going to happen to the UK air arms in the next decade or so. Tim, where to start? There's some good news. This isn't all about cuts, but we're going to lose some of our very favourite airframes, and as geeks, it's a sad time. But as I said, it's not all bad news, is there? There's investment as well.
Yeah, I think one of the key themes that's come out of it is there is been a focus on industrial and technological capabilities of the future and growing those, investing in those against, focus on those. And what's had to be cut is capabilities today that have had to bear the brunt of it. So, the future's looking very bright. There's tempest on the horizon, mosquitoes, swarming drones, space, all that good stuff. And a real emphasis on soft science and technology, and growing the skills base and things like that. But what has had to suffer is kind of current capabilities and these things being chopped. So, 24 early trench one typhoons that are, quite potent. You can still use them in QRA. They're going.
When we retire these 24 typhoons, is there not somebody in the world we can sell these to, or are these literally going to go to the scrap heap?
That is a good question. I mean, I think they'll probably be export restricted to our very, very bestest friends anyway.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting one. I mean, I say that the trench ones are fairly potent kind of weapon systems in any way. If you were thinking, just thinking out of the box, I mean, somebody like maybe the Baltic states, but they're still quite expensive to operate. But if somebody was just interested in air defence, air policing, they weren't in care too much about having Storm Shadow, or they just wanted kind of like a fast interceptor. Maybe there's a country there, or maybe they'll just be used for lots of spares. You've got 24. It's a bit like the when the Harriers went out of service, US Marines snapped them up.
Yeah. Well, how about this for an idea then, Tim? I think they should be put aside to be the new Red Arrows. As my shout. That's what they should do with them. Put 10 on flying duties, keep 4 or 5 spare, and then use the others as spares. There you go.
that would be quite cool. I think that would be pretty expensive.
I'm not in MOD procurement. Yeah.
So what else has come out of the defence review?
Well, we're going to lose the Hawk, aren't we? We're going to lose the T1. I think so that was pretty much on the cards as well.
That was happening anyway. So that's not the Red Arrows. The Red Arrows are going to kind of soldier on, but that is Naval Air Squadron and 100 Squadron that does the aggressor role.
Yeah.
And interestingly, what the RF are talking about that is shifting things to more stuff now to synthetic. So you can do things now in simulations and in virtual battle spaces, things like that, but I think there's a growing awareness or realization that when you do like a big red flag exercise, people now can monitor it a lot easier than they could do maybe in the 80s, 90s. Having that sort of exercise, especially when you've got things like F-35 and you've got stealth fighters and you have EASA radars and data links and low probability of intercept waveforms and swarming drones and stuff. So we want to train. We want to train in secret. We want to train with our allies. We want to train behind a bit. Not let prying eyes see that we're going to suddenly unleash, 200 swarming drones on the enemy, because that's going to give the game away and first day of war and all that. So, but I still think you're going to there's going to be some sort of, you need some sort of aggressor training, handling kind of stuff. Ellie, what do you think? Pilot's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, all these defense cuts, I'm just not quite sure about them. I feel like the military in general as well has just had so many cuts over the years that are we actually going to have any aircraft to fly in 20 years' time? Yeah. I know they're promising
more aircraft,
but... Yeah. Wait, I know they're promising more aircraft, but We seem to be losing something.
Yeah,
there is, and this is the 2010 again, sort of like, you know, Nimrod MRA-4 Harriers, and previous defense cuts then was oh well, you're getting rid of the Harriers, but you're getting F-35. So now F-35 is, well, you're still getting F-35, but we're not going to commit to how many. But then the next thing is, there's jam tomorrow, there's going to be Tempest and Mosquito, kind of UCAVs and swarming drones. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, fewer aircraft to fly, but what they're trying to do is build up the mass in numbers in other ways by UAVs.
On that point, and it does seem that there is a logic to that argument. In the past, and we know from memoirs, and we also know from previous guests on this show, that in effect, the top brass is wheeled in to sit in front of the Minister of Defence, and they're told to cut their budgets by X. It doesn't feel like that this time. It just does feel like the budgets have got to be cut. We know things have to change. Here's a route map to the future. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't like hearing things like the UK will grow or commit to grow its F-35B fleet beyond the 48 aircraft. What I want to know is we've placed an order for 12 new airframes. Because to me, politicians will change their minds. And on the basis they haven't made that commitment, it will never appear. But it does feel slightly better in the way that it's... we're making this transition to the new future.
Or am I just making it sound slightly better?
Are you a politician?
There's some things that doesn't make sense. For example, there's a whole idea of, from the army side, they're talking about kind of ranger regiments, global special forces. We're going to go around, global Britain on the world stage. So, all right. Okay, great. That sounds a cool idea with our allies, but why are you cutting 30% of the RAF's airlift?
Yeah, no, I understand.
In Hercules, and the answer to that is, well, Hercules is getting more and more difficult to maintain. We've got A400M is coming in. It's had teething troubles, but it will be a lot more capable aircraft. Okay, and those sort of arguments. Similar with Sentinel. Spy plane, done great work. Absolutely, sort of asked for asset, but it's getting to the end of not getting to the end of its life, but it's pushed so far, and now people are looking at sort of things like Sentinel. And perhaps you could do this same sort of thing in other ways. So perhaps you could use the EASA radar on an F-35, or perhaps you could use synthetic aperture radar from space satellites. And if you've got a satellite there that's staring down, SAR satellite, it's not a vulnerable radar plane that's stooging around, waiting to get taken out by some kind of a Russian or Chinese long range missile, and the US is having similar sort of wrestling with similar problems, because they JSTARS is their radar spy plane that's the same class, and they're very hesitant to actually replace it or buy a new one, because they're on the cusp of this new technology, that they're now aware that things like AWACS, rivet joint, etc., that they're high value assets. They're just going to be the first in line to get shot out of the sky.
Yeah. We saw on social media some rivet joint activity near Ukraine and the Russian border this week. I don't see any mention of that. Is that simply because it's due to be phased out and they were short term airframes anyway? We're going to see the E-3Ds go in. We know they're being replaced by the wedge tail, the E-7 wedge tail. They're all moving up to Lossiemouth as well.
No. I mean, rivet joint is being kept. Rivet joint is safe. Again, there's things there that make you sort of scratch your head. Like, so the Sentries and Fortune were like a mobile phone, a Nokia mobile phone that we never upgraded. from the 1990s that we kept. You know, it worked, and we could still call people on it. But other people were getting kind of, YouTube and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, and we were stuck with the we never upgraded our handsets in a way, and they've just been getting more and more decrepit and kind of lacking in surface ability. So really, that was a kind of their cards have been marked a long time,
right?
Hence Wedgetail. But the problem now is that it's gone down to three Wedgetails. And if one's training, one's in maintenance, that leaves you one to do something.
Yeah.
Three is unbelievably small number. You know, I know it's an airliner. I know it's a 737 base, so availability be better, et cetera, et cetera. But it can't be in two places at once.
Yeah.
And all you need is it to one to kind of, I don't know, burst a tire, have an overrun, get a bird strike, and your AWACS capability is down by one third, and now what?
Yeah.
So,
and particularly as our current foreign policy is to project force into other parts of the world, there's a big focus on the use of the two carriers and how F-35 is going to project that force around the world, particularly Indo-Pacific and Asia-Pacific and that part of the world. As you said earlier, a bit like projecting the army force, there is some disconnect in there, isn't there, by taking out the Hercules fleet. Yes, we've got the A-400Ms and the C-17s we're leasing, but those are where there are big disconnects. And if we look at the army in particular, they've been quite heavily hit in their traditional weaponry and resources. But we're seeing the Gazelles, 20 Pumas and the Bell 212s going. There is a view, though, being Southwest based and, hand in glove with Ellie here, we're flying a flag for the Southwest. Potentially a new medium lift helicopter. How far out is that, though? That doesn't fit this plan.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't in a way. So there's a couple of different things here. So there is a NATO requirement for a medium helicopter, and the UK is involved with, and it's going to replace things like Puma, NH90, Black Hawks that are here and there. That are being operated, I think it's almost 1,000 airframes across Europe. It's a big requirement, and it's going to be multi kind of role. So NATO are looking at this. That's further in the future, and sort of industry is just kind of getting to grips with it about, well, what do we offer? Do we offer something like a tilt rotor, or like the Americans, or compound, or what's really required here? Does it just have to be cheap? And I think in Europe there's more of a focus on, it's got to be interoperable, it's got to be maintainable, it's got to be cheap, and, well, it's not cheap, affordable. So Puma comes out of service before then, so the Puma will need a medium, RAF Puma will need a helicopter before then. So what at the moment is obviously Leonardo helicopters, and they are proposing the AW159. No, hang on, the 159 is the Wildcat. That's not right. No, it's not the Wildcat. 149, sorry. What am I talking about? 149. It's a 14 something. So they're proposing that. Airbus are coming in with the H175, which is a civil helicopter that is part made with China. That they're putting forward that. And there's various, obviously, kind of the US are obviously interested as well. So potentially there's, you know, Black Hawks being proposed. But one thing that's come out of it that a lot of people have missed is one of the things in the defense review or the integrated review or the industrial strategy review was a clause there that said something along the lines of, and I'm paraphrasing here, is we're now going to reverse a policy from 2012 and we're going to prioritize, you know, UK equipment for UK forces that supports the UK economy and technology. You know, the UK aerospace, the UK defence industry. So that is a complete 180 from let's buy Bridgetails, let's buy Poseidon,
yeah,
let's buy Protectors, and it's now tilting the equation far more in what can we do it in Britain.
Yeah.
You know, and so, it might be that they look at that and they decide, well, actually, it can't be done in Britain, or there's future things that come up, and you have to sort of say, no, you know, the only thing here is product X, and it's built in America or it's built somewhere else. But yeah, this is a sea change now, and I think one wonders whether, yeah, would P8 Poseidon have got past this? Would Wedgetail, or would it, you know, or so, you know, the smart money, I think, is looking towards, you know, Yeovil and Leonardo, because if it isn't, if it doesn't, it's basically the government saying we don't care about the UK helicopter industry.
We'll see, as you say, we'll see. Let me just jump around a little bit more, because there were a few more things that really did jump out and were a little bit beyond me. Reaper's going to be replaced by Protectors, and they're saying by 2024. That's only 2 or 3 years away now. Tim, what's the difference between the two?
So Protector is got double the endurance. So it goes up from, I think, 24 hours to 48 hours.
Right.
It's got a heavier weapons load. I think it's got de-icing. But crucially, it has also got sense and avoid.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So you can now, and it's certificated to fly in controlled airspace. So
big difference. Yeah, big difference. I mean, I
that
still
means, yeah,
I still feel like Reaper's new. That's how old I am. But that's a big difference, and is a demand again made by lots of countries, and that's the use of UAVs in controlled airspace. It's got to change. So yeah, I can see why that's coming into play. It makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, so it doesn't. It means that you don't have to either fly it out in Nevada or. You don't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be just flown out in ops over Afghanistan. You can now take it off from Waddington, go off, do some work on the ranges. And one of the interesting things, I think, is there is going to be a Sky Guardian. So obviously this is General Atomics. Sky Guardian is what Protector is based on, the RAF Protector.
Yeah.
And they are doing a demo in this summer where they'll be flying a Sky Guardian UAV, I think from Waddington, that's going to be demoing maritime patrol capabilities.
Wow. Okay.
So if you think about how many, you know, one of the key arguments about P8, it's like, oh, well, we haven't got many P8s. And then you think about if you networked a Protector,
yeah,
with maybe a Sonobuoy dispenser, and that protector could stooge around for 48 hours and just kind of cover the North Sea or go off and have a look at the coast of Scotland and tell the P8 when to turn up and, hey, I found something, guys. You should come and have a look at this. That starts to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. Interesting stuff. I'm gonna ask Ellie to come back in because there is a whole new sector here being developed, and that is flying unmanned vehicles. Does that appeal in any way, Ellie, to you? Sitting in a box somewhere flying, or do you have to feel it through the seat of your pants?
I mean,
Excuse the expression.
I have to be honest, it's not my thing. I don't know. I just have like a kind of moral disagreement with flying an unmanned aircraft, and I'm just can't possibly program every possible eventuality, whereas a pilot could adapt to that.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure, but I can see the purpose of them, and I can see how they can be useful.
Yeah, interesting. I would imagine, though, that there will be younger people out there who are starting to hone their skills through the use of flight sims and that sort of thing, where they'd almost be natural fits to do this sort of thing.
Possibly. Or first-person drone racing. Yeah.
You're right. Yeah,
here's a follow-on question for Ellie, right? So as a light aircraft pilot, you know, you're tootling around. Would you be happy if you knew that there was a kind of a Reaper, you know, in your part of the sort of Devon, and it was flying around somewhere, and that would that
yeah.
would that worry you, or kind of think, you know, maybe I'll cut this flight short a little bit? And
yeah, it does to an extent, especially with the fact that I fly a very old aircraft. We don't have all this kind of Garmin stuff and GPS that can tell you where all these other aircraft are. So from that aspect, yeah, I am. And also, somebody flying from essentially a box somewhere would not have any idea about the actual surroundings because you're not there. So you kind of hear about drones coming close to people and all that kind of stuff, but I'm sure there's probably some kind of safety requirement for this kind of thing. So I don't know. I don't really know much about UAVs and stuff. So maybe I need to look into it a bit more.
Have you got invasion stripes in your aircraft?
I do.
Maybe you should paint them bigger.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Ogee, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
Let's pick out the final few bits we wanted to talk about then in the defence review. We've talked Army, we've talked about some of the changes there, a big focus on the RAF. Little impact on the Navy, but big investment come in for space defence, Tim. £6.6 billion in the next 4 years. Into space defence. Where do you think they're going to start targeting that money? Are we going to end up with something like the United Death States?
Star. No, we're not going to get a Death Star. No X-Wings. So no, this is really an interesting time for UK space and especially military space, because it's kind of putting there's been a lot of talk in the past few years about, you know, boosting the UK, getting more muscular and sort of assertive in military space, and it's now past the the giggle test rather than, well, passive giggle test, mostly Kerr and passive giggle test, obviously. But people are now realizing and waking up to the fact that, oh, hang on, you know, you depend on all the stuff on your smartphone, you know, Uber, pizza delivery, you know, kind of stuff like this. It all depends on geolocation stuff. And all that is vulnerable, and bank timing and ATMs and things like that. So there's a realization that this is vulnerable and that it needs to be, it's critical national infrastructure, but it's in orbit.
Yeah.
So this is why people are militaries are getting involved with it. And the idea also is that there is rogue actors there who they don't sort of see it as a global commons. They could interfere with it. It could be just done accidentally. It could be like space weather that disrupts your operations. So this is something that needs more investment in, more focus in. So part of that investment is going to go into Skynet. Obviously, the UK has got a military SATCOMs. So that is going to be there's already a sort of like interim satellite for that, like a gap filler satellite, and then there's going to be something called Skynet Enduring Capability, and that's going to be another military satellite. Requirements are still being understood and kind of developed and understood, and industry is still looking for it, but it will be something that's much more capable, so higher bandwidth. But interestingly, we're also much more protected. So it might have sensors on it. It might have cameras on it to see if any other satellites are trying to sneak up on it. Or it might have a radar warning receiver. So you have radar warning receivers are well known in aircraft since, you know, 60s. You might start equipping military satellites with that so that they'll know that if something is locking on, you know, enemy satellite is locking on, they might move out of the way. Or there's stuff that's been talked about, like bodyguard satellites. And this is another small satellite that can kind of maneuver around the satellite that it's guarding. And if you've got something else that's a rogue satellite or something unfriendly that's heading, it can put itself in between the enemy satellite and yourself. And if necessarily, maybe it sacrifices itself, maybe it jumps in and, you know, moves in front and takes the hit.
Wow.
So it's going to be much more protected. We've got Space Command setting up. We've got there's a new Chief of Space Command, Vice Marshal Paul Godfrey.
Godders.
So, yeah, we know Godders. He is now Mr. Dan Dare. So he's very busy at the moment. The Space Command stood up on the 1st of April. So a highly significant kind of a date. And one of the other interesting things that they're looking at is you know, space awareness, you know, what's in orbit, what are we tracking? But also there's a sea change there in the UK is set to reverse decades of its military space policy by not relying entirely on the US for spy sats. So we've always shared information and intelligence through the Five Eyes, and we've always had access to you know, US spy sat imagery, you know, imagery, kind of data imagery. That's all now in the commercial center as well. You know, you look on Google Maps.
Yeah.
There's Planet Labs. There's people now producing this sort of stuff. But if you've got your own satellite, you can therefore target stuff that you want whenever you want. You know, if you've got that sovereign capability, you can say, right, we've got a crisis in this part of the world. Get me over flight here. You don't have to ask for anybody else's permission. You don't have to buy it from some of a commercial satellite company. And again, if it's on the free market, that may tip off somebody else as well as what you're looking at.
Yeah.
So
fascinating.
So we are going to be developing our own sort of, you know, it's early days, but the ambition there is to grow and develop our own ISR spy sat capabilities. It's never going to rival the US, but there's interesting stuff in what can be done with it. And also things like OneWeb. So you look at OneWeb that has been invested in, UK has invested in that. It's normally a civil system. It's broadband connectivity, you know, 5G from space, high speed. But there's ideas there that, well, maybe you could turn that into a GPS star system.
Yeah.
And if you've got thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit, yes, the maths is more difficult because you're going around faster and you're going around the Earth lower orbit. But thousands of satellites makes it much more difficult for any adversary to take them out and disrupt your GPS. And the signals also are closer to the Earth, so they're stronger. So at the moment, it is quite easy. For people to, jam, disrupt, decoy GPS because the signals are faint. You know, they're coming in and they're very faint. So it can be, and then you have to have you have to have anti GPS jammers, and you know, most militaries will equip their bombs and their weapons and their aircraft with the anti jamming stuff. But having something lower down providing a higher signal is also so this is it. This is really, really interesting, groundbreaking stuff where the UK could have, you know, we've got OneWeb and maybe it's got some kind of military uses as well, or for communication. So, and it's something perhaps that we could offer to the US, not to replace GPS, but hey, this is a resilient system.
Yeah, resilience.
If your satellites ever go down, you can use ours, or it could be a communications network of, you could easily think about how, one or two of these satellites might be, equipped with, sensors, full motion video. And they might beam stuff up to a Skynet, back down across the other side of the Earth, and you could get, you know, a Tempest pilot in, say, 2040 could get full motion video into their cockpit from the other side of the world, because now you've got this kind of orbital internet, if you like, and it's not just a kind of a thing where you have one ground station, one satellite. And it goes up and it goes down, and then you have to wait another 90 minutes, and it goes up and it down. You have to wait another one. You've got now the potential for this kind of resilient, dynamic kind of internet.
Wow.
So was that a bit complex?
No. Well, on that very exciting note, we'll leave the defence review there. Actually quite fascinating to see how it unfolds. Some gaps, and we've talked about a few of those, but on the whole, exciting times. So let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about some feedback and promoting aerospace.
Hi, it's Dave Homewood here from the Wings Over New Zealand show. New Zealand's a very aviation-minded country, and we have a diverse range of stories out there to tell. The Wings Over New Zealand show brings you all sorts of stories, such as interviews with pilots or ground crew, World War II veterans, post-war Air Force personnel, air show stories, historians, authors, warbird restorers, airline stories, recreational flyers and home builders, agricultural aviation such as top dressing, and a lot, lot more. We've got an extensive archive that you can go back to and listen to all of the shows, and there are new shows coming out all the time. The Wings Over New Zealand show, bringing you New Zealand aviation stories since 2011.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, some feedback from episode 114 on the Korean Air War. Was really popular. Michael Napier was a really popular guest, so we thank Mike for his time. And as you heard on the recording, we are going to have Mike back to talk to us about some other aspects of his work, but also some earlier parts of his career as well, because I'm sure he's got some fascinating stories there. Just want to pick out a few people to say thank you to: Glenn Towler and Richard Bryant, good listeners to the show, long-standing listeners, so appreciated your feedback in particular. But I want to make a big shout out and request to those who haven't connected with us or left any feedback. As you probably hear 100 times on lots of podcasts, that request for feedback on your podcast playing app, on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever your app is that you use, please, 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 can you give us a score, give us a rating, and give us some feedback? We have been around for a long time, so we've sort of gone off the boil. Not many people have left feedback, but we know we've got a lot of new listeners, some of which obviously have listened to more than one program, so you must be enjoying something. Please leave us some feedback. Please get those scores in. It literally takes less than a minute to do. We'd really, really appreciate that. So thank you for those who have given us feedback. And please, for those who haven't, please go over and give us a minute of your time. Okay, over to promoting aerospace. Tim, I was going to mention the Yuri Gagarin books by Stephen Walker, but we've talked about that. I've got a shout out for my local airfield. You know, as things start to open up here in the UK, we have the opportunity now to maybe venture a little bit further than our immediate vicinity. I'm going to go to my local airfield this weekend, socially distance, all safe, with my daughter. We're going to go and watch some aeroplanes fly and give a bit of support to that local airfield. A lot of their income comes from the coffees and teas they serve to the likes of people like us, and they obviously have lost almost a year's worth of revenue. So if you can go out there, please do go and support your local airfield. I'll be out at Compton Abbas, so anyone flying in, I don't think Ellie will be, but anyone flying in, do give us a shout. We'll come over and say hi. Tim, any shout outs?
Yeah, I mean, so I've got shout outs for shows are back, so not all of them. So we're still missing some of the big key ones in the summer, but the good news is Duxford has announced dates for its summer air show, 24th, 25th of July, and Flying Legends, Touchwood, is going to be on at Sewell Aerodrome at 11th of July. So hopefully things will be opened up there for a grand day out at both these air shows, and that'd be really good to go and support them. The one other thing we've got for a shout out is we have a new Aero Society careers portal thing. I'm not going to read out the address, because honestly, it's really long.
We'll put a link in the show notes.
But if you look at my Twitter, you can find it there. But basically, it's a login portal, and it's got things like an AI-powered CV checker and an AI interview simulator.
Okay.
As long with masses of resources of things like interview tips, CV tips, emotional intelligence tutorials, stuff like that. I mean, it's staggering the amount of stuff on there. So, just a really, really useful resource. Not just for young people. Just graduates or people thinking about jobs, but also if you are a RES member and you are you've been between jobs because of this pandemic and stuff, apparently it's becoming really useful for people in the middle of their careers coming back and just sharpening up their CVs and just making sure that, oh yeah, hang on, you know, I've got everything down here, it is up to date, this is what employers are looking for. So really useful resource.
Okay, thanks for that. Ellie, I was just going to come over and ask you, I know it's a very long way away, the summer. You've got a lot of exams and a lot of other business between now and then. But any plans to do any particularly special fly-in or go to any fly-ins or displays or anything like that for you?
Yeah, well, I keep telling myself it's only 8 weeks away, so it's not long, really, hopefully.
Like it.
But I have the whole summer, so I'm planning on doing it as much as possible. So I really want to go to the Isle of Scilly because I haven't been there before.
Okay.
And my dad is practically begging me to fly in there, so that sounds like fun. I've also been invited to the Shuttleworth air shows, so it'll be cool to fly in there at some point. And yeah, it'll be really cool. Hopefully this summer I can just fly into as many different airfields as possible and as many different fly-ins as possible.
The Isles of Scilly, that's a cross-water flight. Any particular arrangements you have to make for that?
Yeah, so we actually flew to Belgium not long ago, so we had to cross the channel for that, which was fun. But obviously you've got to carry extra equipment. You've got to carry life rafts, and you've got to have your vests and what am I talking about? You've got to have all that kind of stuff, which looks terrible, but it's important. And really it's just flying at a higher altitude than you would have and just being very conscious about carb heat and your engine maintenance and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To kind of keep safe. There's actually a saying that your engine sounds different when you're flying over water. It's actually really, really true. You suddenly, the engine just doesn't sound like it's the same, and it's kind of psychological, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll keep track on you for that.
Is the LAA doing any air shows, meets?
So the LAA do have an LAA rally, which I can't actually remember the date of, but I think that is still going ahead. I think.
Well, maybe that's something we can have a talk about maybe when we get together in a month or so's time. That'd be a good topic to promote then. Okay, that's it then. I'm afraid I've got to put the nail in it there. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show, and of course the extended family of supporters. Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian, Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiast Book Club, and Andy Wright at Aircrew Book Review. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license. Okay, over to social media. Ellie, let me come to you first. Whereabouts can we find you online?
I'm on Twitter at DragonGirl94. I'm on Instagram with EllieCarter74 and Facebook with just Ellie Carter.
And Tim, where can we find you?
Yeah, I'm Aureus Tim R on Twitter, and you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
Excellent. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course at the Aviation Extended Twitter and Facebook pages. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Ellie Carter.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a stall, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
AW159, is that right?
I'm not sure. I'm not. So, yeah. I'm not a helicopter. I like helicopters, but no about them. Oops.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.